I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Some people have never shelled peas or shucked corn. Other people have never harvested cranberries. Both you and I are very likely to be in this latter category. I wouldn't even know where the nearest cranberry farm is from home. Do you? Actually, I looked it up. From where I am in Utah, the nearest cranberry production is happening in Oregon, but Wisconsin is actually our country's top producer of cranberries, and only 5 states grow them commercially. We're off to Wisconsin right now to hear about a berry that most of us think of as inextricably connected to food fare at Thanksgiving time. And to help paint the cranberry scene, we have with us Liesl Detlefsen. She's author of a picture book titled Time for Cranberries and is a member of a family that has grown cranberries for generations. Liesl Detlefsen, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Liesl, you know, sometimes people spend their early years in life growing up. They think, I'm going to be an astronaut or I'm going to be president of the United States. And then they end up living on a cranberry farm. And that's I'm just wondering, if you look back at this, does it just kind of give you a little bit of whiplash?
It's really funny because I grew up drinking cranberry juice every morning. And I didn't even think about where those cranberries were grown or how they got turned into juice or how they made it to my table. And it was my intention to move to a big city, New York, Chicago, Minneapolis. And as I like to put it, I met my husband and got a little sidetracked, or very sidetracked, and wound up living on one of the oldest continually family-owned cranberry marshes in the state, which is something I'm very proud of. And I get to do the work I love to do because of where I live, but definitely was not the path I had intended while growing up.
Well, did you have to go through a significant mental adjustment? Did you suck in your breath and say, okay, it's cranberries from here on out?
Yeah, it was a big change of pace, particularly after college. I graduated with my art degree from UW-Madison, where, you know, I couldn't walk down the street without seeing a dozen people I know. And then when I moved to the farm, I only knew my husband initially. So it was a big adjustment to learning other people in the community and kind of getting to know where I was and kind of shifting gears from being a more extroverted person to being in a slightly more isolated area and kind of learning to adjust to that and embrace that. There's a lot of things I love about it now that were initially difficult to kind of get used to.
Yeah, well, what about the marsh thing? Is it a nice thing to say I'm going to live now next to a marsh?
It is now, and I think particularly in this time where it's what's been a really welcome thing to be able to go outside and have room to run and for my kids to have room to play and have that ability to have land has really been a luxury, especially the last year and a half or so. But definitely was an adjustment to the fact that, you know, even just going to the grocery store is a bit of a daily adventure. You know, it takes a while to get there, getting the kids to school. We are definitely isolated, a little far from things I love, like theater and art museums and things like that. But with the internet that we have, I'm really lucky, too, that I can do the work that I do on picture books from just about anywhere.
Right, right. Well, cranberries is the topic of one of your picture books. Let's get into cranberry culture and learn a little bit about this. You know, I have to confess, I am among the people who was ignorant for many years, thinking that these berries are kind of aquatic, that they're always growing in water. I was wrong.
You are not alone in having that misconception, I think, especially because our Ocean Spray commercials were so successful with Henry and Justin standing in the waders in the bog with the floating fruit. A lot of people think cranberries grow in water, and they do not. They grow in a sandy soil. They're a perennial plant, so we harvest the same vines year after year. And it's a pretty gorgeous sight, though, when we do harvest using the water to help move the cranberries. I always say the first harvest I ever saw was a little bit like Dorothy stepping into Oz. It's like I'd been living in a black and white world, and all of a sudden it was just technicolor. The leaves on the trees were changing colors, and the red fruit and the berries bobbing on the water, and it's a really beautiful harvest. If you have the opportunity to come see it, I highly recommend it.
Just a saturated color experience.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a wife who loves berries, and she went to Vermont one season, and she would go out wherever she could find the wild berries growing, and she had to contend with a lot of thorns. Tell me more about the cranberry plant. Is it thorny? Is it? Can you walk through them? Are they all tangled and matted? How do they look?
Yeah, so the cranberries grow on an upright, we call them uprights, and it's a vine. It's a woody plant. There's no thorns. There's a lot of little leaves, and I will tell you, those leaves love to make their way into our boots and our jackets and on our floor. They definitely get everywhere. But you can walk out on the bed, and in fact, just a few days ago, I was hand raking cranberries just for the cranberries we use just for ourselves in our own family. And we just walk right out on the vines and we pick the fruit, and you can definitely walk on there. And we have several different varieties. Cranberries are something that, just like apples, you know, you have your different varieties of apples, like a Granny Smith and a Macintosh and a Honeycrisp. We have several different varieties of cranberries that we grow as well. And that allows us to harvest them at slightly different times, too.
Oh, okay. So as a consumer going to the store, I would never see them packaged by their specific type of cranberry, would I?
No, you wouldn't. And in fact, it's very hard for someone who isn't in the culture, if you will, to identify the differences. We have four different varieties we grow on our farm, and my youngest son will tell you that they all taste different, but most general consumers would not be able to tell the difference between the different berries, which is different than like an apple, sure.
Well, I want to stay in the field or in that marsh. Is it a misnomer to call it a marsh, actually, if it's sandy soil?
Well, so interestingly, in Wisconsin, we call them marshes. On the East Coast, they tend to be called bogs, and on the West Coast, they tend to be called farms. And it does have to do a little bit with just regional differences, but also the way the proximity to water.
And we will talk about the water, its essential use in the harvesting and the techniques there. But first, while these are growing, are they beautiful flowers? Are they inconspicuous flowers?
Oh, they are a beautiful flower. In fact, every late spring, so kind of the end of June, we have these beautiful little delicate white and pink blossoms that come out, and they look like the head and neck of a sandhill crane, and that's where cranberry got their name from, is when the early settlers came over and they saw these blossoms on these natively growing plants. They said, oh, those are craneberries. Eventually that E got dropped, and now we have cranberries. But my husband gives me a bouquet of cranberry blossoms every spring. Which I think is that's the height of romance here where we live, but it's something I look forward to every year.
Are those blossoms aromatic?
Not very. They have a very, very, you don't smell them very strongly at all. And in fact, we bring in bees to help with pollination, and we have to bring in quite a few because the bees are much more attracted to clover than they are to the cranberry plant because of their lack of smell.
Now, I'm very interested in the tending of the plant before the berries have even set on these vines. I'm just wondering about what a farmer is worried about most in caring for those. It's not just that you just sit around waiting for the berries to be harvested. There's work to do.
There absolutely is, yes. So a lot of things need to happen throughout the year with the perennial plant, particularly this one. Moisture levels are very important. That plant likes a very specific amount of moisture. It can't be too dry or too wet. Of course, we don't have a lot of control over temperature, but that's something we worry about too. And then when it gets too cold, frost watch is definitely something we need to do to protect the plants. So we will spray the plants with a sprinkler system, and that water going over the cranberry plants will help protect it from freezing itself. So we have to do that mostly in the spring and then again in the fall. Last night was a good example of that. Our farm just finished this week, so we escaped the frost, but many of our neighboring marshes were having to run their sprinkler systems to protect the fruit from frost last night.
Now, are you chasing animals out of there? Are there skunks that get in there? Are there predators, or I should say marauders, who are coming in and pilfering the berries?
We have quite a few animals who either like to eat them or trample them, and that can be an issue. But we mostly think of the wildlife as just a lovely addition to the farm home that we have. But we see a lot of deer, a lot of geese, some swans. We have bald eagles out here, just a wide array of beautiful wildlife, including cranes, of course. You know, our namesake there, the sandhill cranes. which are lovely to see out here too.
You know, I cannot stop myself. I'm going to ask the monoculture question. Is there a problem with just growing a single crop? Are you of the mindset that somehow the cranberry culture is benefited when there's some diversification of what's planted around them?
That is not a great question for me to answer. I do know that most of the farms in our area just grow cranberries and have for generations. And with it being a perennial crop, so we're not planting year after year after year, there's not that same detriment that you can have to the land like you do with a row crop that you're having to, you know, take nutrients out of and then try to replant every year.
Yeah, see, you are the right person to answer that question because that's a very important point with the difference between annual crops. You know, when I drive across Nebraska, for instance, and I see acre after acre of what looks like just sunflowers, you know, that kind of experience, it makes you wonder sometimes if this is, you know, an unnatural landscape. Do you feel like you're living in a natural landscape?
Oh, I do. I mean, cranberries were growing here when my husband's great-great-grandfather came here. And I just asked him this morning, I said, what is our oldest bed? Because we do, you know, harvest from the same vines for many years. And there are vines that we're still harvesting on our farm that are older than me and my husband that were planted in the early 1970s. So it's definitely an unusual type of agriculture in that we have these vines that we are harvesting for many, many years. We're really kind of working with the land and very, very lucky to be in the situation we are, surrounded by wildlife and beautiful woods, and it's a lovely place to live.
So are the farmlands, are these areas kind of off limits to people? Do you have tourists coming? Do you have people who stumble across the area and say, what's going on here? Or are there even sort of outreach efforts to kind of educate the public?
Sure. So there are some marshes that do tours. We have a pretty famous cranberry festival in Warrens, Wisconsin, not far from here. And then when we're harvesting right on the, we have some county roads that are adjacent to our farm, and people will stop and sometimes kind of wander through. That can be difficult because we're trying to do a job, and, you know, we don't want people getting, you know, injured or hurt in the way or slowing things down. But we also really do like to share the story with others, and that's kind of where I come in with my writing. I'm not on the farm doing the day-to-day operations, but one of my biggest missions in life is to tell the story of our family and our farm and what the growers around us are doing through my books. And I go into schools and I talk to kids about where their cranberries are coming from. I don't want them to grow up like I did, drinking juice but not having a concept of all the effort that goes into making that possible.
I'm going to turn you into my therapist for a little bit. Liesl, I have had the experience of opening a bag of frozen cranberries, thawing them out, and just biting into one. That was not a pleasant thing to do.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, because we eat them raw here all the time.
Do you? They must be riper. Maybe I got some that were picked too soon.
Well, you know what? I think if they were frozen, the texture probably had, you know, the texture's not as good as a nice, fresh, raw cranberry. My youngest will eat them by the handful. That's his favorite thing to do, is ride around the back of his dad's truck and just eat raw cranberries by the handful.
Well, even without sweeteners on them?
Oh, yeah, just completely raw. They're not too tart fresh, in my opinion. But I tell you what, next time you get some caramel dip, too, and put a cranberry on a toothpick and dip it in caramel.
Ah, now
I think you'll have a different reaction.
Well, I don't dislike them. I love cranberries. I just have, you know, straight from the package, I didn't think that anybody had any reason to do that.
They are very tart, but you can absolutely eat them raw. I like to make cranberry pie or cranberry muffins or scones, and that's a little more palatable to a lot of people. And then, of course, we have dried cranberries, which are sweeter. They're kind of unusual fruit in that they get more tart as they ripen as opposed to sweeter. So the earlier harvested cranberries are actually a little sweeter.
Ah, that's really unusual.
Yeah.
Would you flood a marsh for us now and give us a brief picture of how this harvesting takes place?
Sure. So when the fruit is ready to harvest, we have these, we have kind of a low-tech system called bulkheads where we have reservoirs that come off of the Wisconsin River. We're able to let that water come in. It's a gravity-fed system where the boards are pulled out of a bulkhead, and water slowly fills into that bed. as that water is rising up, we have a machine called a harrow that is driven through the cranberry bed a little bit over 3 miles an hour. And that picks the fruit by kind of just gently plucking it off the vine. When that fruit is ready to be picked, it doesn't take a lot of force. And then those berries kind of float up. One of the really cool things about a cranberry is a good berry will bounce and float because it's got four pockets of air inside. And once those cranberries are floating, it's much easier to move them. So then once the berries are floating, we'll have a tractor on either end of the bed with a floating boom. And as those tractors drive, they collect those cranberries along the boom. And then we're able to get them up into a suction pump and into a cleaner. And they kind of go on a conveyor into a delivery truck.
So you kind of corral them in a way.
Yes, that's the perfect word for it, is we call that corralling.
Oh, you actually call it that?
We do.
Yeah. And then off they go to market. Has the farming of cranberries had its ebb and flow in terms of profitability? Is this a segment of the farming population that is white-knuckled and biting its lips because business is kind of sketchy sometimes?
Well, you know, any kind of agriculture has ups and downs, and that can be very difficult, and cranberries is not immune to that. And certainly you can have crops that are up and down, too. And my husband always says he only has control over about 4% of what happens with the crop, because Mother Nature definitely has a big say in what happens to the end result there. But we are part of the Ocean Spray Co-op, and we're really happy to be part of a co-op where the farmers actually own the business. So that's something that we're very proud of, and we've been a part of Ocean Spray since 1956 as a farm. And all of our fruit that we harvest goes into juice and craisins and sauce, but there is a different picking process for fresh fruit.
Yeah, now, just last of all, because this is a family business that's gone back for generations, and because you married into the family, do you kind of get the rhythm of that kind of a life now? Do you feel that it's a good fit for you and that the legacy is something that is in your bones now?
I do. I'm very proud to be a part of this business. We just celebrated our 150th anniversary as a farm, which was a really wonderful celebration with my husband's family and cousins and, you know, kind of extended relatives and friends from the area. And 3 years ago, we moved into the original homestead, so the house that was built in the 1870s. And as we were renovating that, I got a greater appreciation, too, for the generations that came before. And I read the memoirs of Sherman Whittlesey, who was the original, the generation one of our family. And he talked about when he married his wife, who was from Chicago, so certainly another city girl, and how when they moved up to the farm, they had her baby grand piano strapped to the back of a horse-drawn wagon, and it got stuck in the mud. And he had to leave her to go find help to get the wagon unstuck. And I always picture her. I picture Annie, and I think, what must she have been thinking to have gone from Chicago to the wild wilderness of Wisconsin in the 1870s on this farm? You know, there was no home yet. There was they didn't have the internet. They didn't have Amazon. They didn't have Surrey to help get them where they needed to go. And I think about the evolution she had to make as a person to make this place her home. And suddenly my evolution doesn't feel quite as difficult, but I feel very fortunate to be a part of this family and part of this really neat business and helping feed other people.
Yeah, there's just a little hint of Ma from the Laura Ingalls Wilder stories. Somebody going out into a foreboding place with little contact with the rest of humanity. Liesl, you tell a great story, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed my time with you.
Liesl Detlefsen with us. She was inspired by her life on the cranberry farm to produce her book, the picture book, Time for Cranberries. You're listening to a Constant Wonder Thanksgiving special. We're going to turn from cranberries now to one of the grand American traditions at Thanksgiving. It's a tradition that owes a great deal to a pioneering puppeteer. Still to come on Constant Wonder, the story of Tony Sarg and the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. In November 2020, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City was, like so much else, reconfigured as a virtual event. A parade in the middle of a pandemic with airborne germs that just was not to be. But massive airborne puppets were too big a tradition to drop the celebration altogether. So much of the event was then taped in advance and pieced together for a televised version. This parade isn't quite a century-long tradition, but very close now. There's a gap in its history for World War II because large crowds were not permitted to assemble, but also, very interestingly, because helium needed to be conserved for military use. We thought it would be enjoyable to go back to the beginnings of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and hear a little bit about its origin in connection with the puppeteer Tony Sarg, and we've got just the guy to tell us about it. Bart Rockaberton joins with us now. He's the current director of the Puppet Arts Program at the University of Connecticut and has been a professional puppet artist for nearly 50 years. Bart, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Marcus. Happy to be here.
So, you know, until I learned about you and Tony Sarg, I had never really thought of the Macy's Day balloons as upside-down marionette puppets. I guess that's kind of what they are.
Yes. As a matter of fact, he referred to them as that very thing.
Tony Sarg is a name that you encountered long before I did. Shall we talk a little bit about him as a puppeteer first?
Sure, of course. He is referred to as the father of modern American puppetry. He is German-born, but was born in Ecuador. His parents were diplomats, and when they moved back to Germany, his family, that was a very artistic family, encouraged his interest in drawing and illustrating. His grandmother also interested him in mechanical toys, and so this was very much part of his life. Germany at this time period is a rather unstable place. It's not the Germany that we know today, and so part of his requirements of being a German citizen was to be in the military. This was not of interest to him, and so he moved to London, where he got a job as an illustrator for various magazines and newspapers, much in the way that, you know, a photojournalist will now take photos. Tony was sent out to do illustrations of events happening around London. He was very interested when he was sent to illustrate the performance of Thomas Holden, a marionettist. And Tony asked, could he go backstage and see the way the puppets worked? And he was given a resounding no. At this time, marionettists hung a fabric that was known as the canvas around the back of the stages. So even the stagehands couldn't see how they performed their tricks. Tony decided to go to the show a number of times, sitting in the front row and sketching. And I can only imagine him leaning forward and looking up to the puppeteer's bridge so he could see what the controllers looked like. And this sort of stemmed his interest in puppetry. He started making marionettes, and being a member of an artistic community in London, invited to many soirees, and he noticed that all his other friends had other arts that they dabbled in as hobbies. So he decided marionettes would be his hobby, and he started performing. But as we got to 1914, and Europe became an unwelcome place for Germans, he and his American-born wife moved to New York City, where he became America's, you know, father of modern American puppetry.
I'm just imagining him as an illustrator for a newspaper looking at the marionette show and trying to figure it out. Have you ever been in that position where you're looking at a puppet and you know it's got some kind of contraption that makes it work and you've been trying to figure it out?
Oh, yeah. Every puppeteer does that. We are fascinated by the animation that other artists can get from their puppets, and it might come down to the type of joint. It might come down to the way it's animated, the way it's controlled. And so, yeah, anytime any of us see a puppet, we're trying to figure out how it
happens.
Yeah,
I thought so. And what about the collegiality among puppeteers these days? Are there still trade secrets the way it was back then? Where you got to keep this under wraps.
Yeah, not so much. Tony, actually, when he got to New York, he once again was an illustrator, and there are many beautiful illustrations that he did of Manhattan and that are available you can go on Amazon.com and find a Tony Sarg Manhattan book. But he started performing his marionettes again. And it happened that a Broadway producer had booked a German marionette company to come to Broadway for the Christmas season. And because of the war, the German company was not able to come. So this producer turned to Tony Sarg at a party and said, "Would you like to do a Broadway show?" And Tony, without batting an eye, said, "Sure." And that started his company, which eventually toured across the 48 contiguous states for a number of years. He brought a lot of gifts to puppetry. He, unlike Thomas Holden, invited journalists backstage, invited the public to see the way the puppets were done. He actually wrote the first American book on puppetry on how to do it. So he dropped the canvas and he made it available. And this spirit continues through puppetry today. I can't think of any, well, maybe I can think of two or three people who don't want to share. But most puppeteers are more than open to to give and share back and forth.
Well, we are going to get to the story of those upside-down marionette puppets in a bit and the connection with the Macy's Day Parade and Tony Sarg's role in it. First, though, to say that Tony Sarg is the father of puppetry in the United States is hardly to say that puppets haven't been around for a very long time.
Oh, that's true.
Could you just give us a glimpse of some of the backstory long before Tony Sarg and fascinating applications of puppets in societies and cultures in Europe and elsewhere?
Of course. Well, in Europe, puppetry has been a means of expression for quite a long time. Back in the Middle Ages, when we, the people, were illiterate and the priests wanted us to know the holy stories, they invited puppets into the churches to perform the stories from the Bible. And it's believed that because the marionettes performed the nativity so frequently, that they received the term Little Marys or marionettes. This has been part of our Western culture for quite a while, but even before the Europeans started coming to this continent, there was puppetry and mask performance among the native tribes, both as fertility figures and also just for ritual.
Yeah, you're talking about across multiple cultures. I mean, it would take an anthropologist probably to map out the whole scope of how little figurines have played into sacred and cultural experience across the globe. Have you dipped in globally? I know you've traveled the world in your own puppetry. Have you gleaned from Asia and from maybe Africa? Or have you drawn from those sources yourself?
Oh, absolutely. American puppetry, as we know it today, has been gleaned from international performances. So, you know, we have the English hand puppet, the Italian mask, the German string puppet have all been bundled together in American puppetry. I have done a lot of travel in Asia. I've worked in China and Hong Kong and Taiwan, and it's been fascinating to learn the methods of puppet animation that we hadn't considered before. So here at the University of Connecticut, where I run the puppet arts program, I've incorporated the performance of Chinese rod puppetry into our work, or of the Japanese bunraku. So there is a lot that has come into American puppetry from around the world. And what's most interesting is that now the rest of the world is starting to imitate us. What goes around comes around.
Well, now you said what goes around comes around. I'm thinking about those spinning balloons at the Macy's Parade, because they go around sometimes, don't they? They spin them around. Let's talk about Tony Sarg's aha moment. He was employed, I understand, for a while doing window displays for Macy's?
Yes. It was very much part of the immigrant culture, if you will, of the United States, that there were many immigrants working at Macy's, and Tony started working with ideas that he wanted to share, and he found ways of incorporating the workers in Macy's to help him do displays. So, yeah, what we know as animated window displays, Tony started doing in the 19-teens in the Macy's windows in New York.
And the parade doesn't get going in the teens quite. I believe it was in the mid-20s or so when the parade gets going. Does he kind of say, "Hey, I can do this"?
I honestly can't answer that. What I know of Tony Sarg is that he he was bold. He convinced himself that he could do things that, you know, like the Broadway producer saying to him, do you want to do a Broadway show? He goes, yes. And bang, he's doing Broadway shows. So, you know, whether it was his own instigation or that of several people, I can't tell you for sure.
But he wouldn't shy away from it.
He did not shy away from it in any means.
Yeah. Literally, the balloons on those tethers were conceived as an upside-down marionette. Were they, do you suppose, conceived as something that should do more than just float down the street, that they might be able to have, you know, more animation?
Well, yes. I don't hear of any of the balloons being used in a story performance, but I do know that initially, once the parade ended, they would release the balloons. And there were rewards offered for those who would return the balloons. This stopped pretty quickly because people started taking shots at them with shotguns.
Oh, my. Well, that's a lot of material to come down. They're big, and I would imagine they could do some damage coming down, too.
And pretty heavy, I'm sure, because originally they were heavy canvas and rubber painted onto the canvas, so they must have weighed a lot.
So we've established that these balloons are more than just balloons. They're kind of puppets, but not to put too fine a point on all of this, isn't there kind of a limit to what you can call a puppet? I mean, does that definition of these balloons as puppets, does that in any way rankle you at all?
No. In all honesty, and you must forgive me because I immodestly feel that puppetry is the center point of virtually every creative human endeavor. We refer to some things as performance objects, not specifically puppets, but they are objects that are used to tell a story, to create character, to share ideas. Puppeteers have broad imaginations. So, no, these are absolutely puppets, no question about it.
Well, at the very least, if you say that puppets or these performance, what did you call them, performance?
Performance objects.
Objects. If they're capable of conveying an idea or a story or a symbol, sometimes I would imagine that's just done by illusion, because if people have the known stories, if there's some Disney character there that we're familiar with, all you have to do is put the thing in the air in front of people's eyes, and immediately they're going to have all those associations.
Exactly. You know, illusion is a good word to use with puppetry, because there's nothing that we do that is not illusion. We take an object, we move it in a certain way with an intent, and we add sound to it. We require the audience to see what we're doing and hear what we're saying and to add it together in their own mind. So between the puppeteer and the audience, the life of the puppet is created. So the audience is a very important element in puppetry. What you just described is actually the way I have seen African performances presented. Them bring out a character of a rabbit, and then the rabbit would go back, and then a character of a hippopotamus would come out, and it would go back. And when I talked to the artists afterwards, I said, you know, I didn't understand the story. He said, well, it's because you don't know the stories. All we have to do is introduce the characters. The audience knows the story. So, like you said, we see Underdog coming down Fifth Avenue.
I'm so glad you said Underdog. He's one of my favorites.
Well, you know, the object, the sculpture, the character design, all is alive, and it's only our imagination that needs to join it. So for me, when Underdog comes down the street and I see his limbs waving as the wind blows it, he's flying down that street.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in a way, if illusion is involved here, you know, magicians will do this too, right? They make you think you're seeing something you might not really be seeing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of tricky. That's kind of it stops short of a prank until maybe it does become a prank. And I know there's a Tony Sarg story where he took a big balloon, I guess, up to Nantucket.
Yes. Tony, as I understand, and I should say that a lot of my information about Tony comes from Margot Rose, who actually worked with Tony as a puppeteer, and she was one of my mentors. You know, she described him as always working. If he was not directing a show, he was drawing, he was creating characters. And when he relaxed, quote unquote, he liked to go to Nantucket, where he would paint and draw And eventually he opened up a curiosity shop on Nantucket to sell some of the things that he had created and also just interesting things. Well, there came in 1937 a report that a sea monster had been seen off the coast of Nantucket. And lo and behold, footprints, giant footprints, appeared on the beach. And there are photographs of men measuring the size of these footprints and trying to determine how large this monster was. Well, the next day, floating in on the surf, comes one of Tony's balloons of a sea monster. And it landed on the beach and attracted, of course, a huge crowd. It's known as the Nantucket Sea Serpent. One of my interesting contacts with this, a dear friend named Allie Lou Curtin, was a child whose family visited Nantucket. And at the age of five, she actually got to see the sea serpent and she's given me photos of herself as a five-year-old standing next to Tony Sark. So it's an interesting connection.
You know, as you've been talking, and you mentioned Margot and her connection to Tony, and all of this just tells me that there is kind of a genealogy among the puppeteers, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. Tony influenced Margot. Margot influenced me and hundreds of other puppeteers. We referred to her as the Grand Dame of American puppetry. And she shared with us. And then Bill Baird, a name you would probably know. His marionettes are renowned for the Lonely Goat Herd in The Sound of Music. But he was much more beyond just that. When we landed on the moon the first time, we didn't have the digital media that we have today where they could show us what it was going to be like. And so Bill was actually hired to perform with marionettes what it would be like for the astronauts to move across the surface of the moon. And they actually set up in Rockefeller Center with marionettes on a moonscape.
That's almost outlandish. I mean, the idea that we're going to convey to the general public what the moon landing is like, and we're going to do it with puppets.
Yep. Yes.
Well, this is very interesting because I know that I happen to have met somebody here in Utah years ago who used puppets to teach things in Central America like dental hygiene or, an educational tool. What's your angle on using puppets to educate?
Oh, it's very much. I've actually, in the past when I wasn't running this program at UConn, I actually did school workshops that I refer to as puppetry, a dynamic classroom tool. And we would go into the classroom and talk with the teacher and say, what is your focus in this period? Let's build a show that helps you reinforce that. And it was interesting because there was one classroom that was studying mammals. And I had them make shadow puppets of the various mammals they were doing. And as the kids performed on the screen and said, I'm a blue whale and I'm a mammal and I do this, I do that, we realized that the kids were actually giving us more information than they had written down in their reports. It was that they had tapped into the knowledge and were able to freely share it.
Yeah, so they get to perform what they know rather than just recite what they know.
Mm-hmm.
That seems very important in a way. I'm not an educator, but I would imagine that reinforces an experience that can last for years.
I hope so, and I've actually had conversations with teachers whose classrooms I had been in 20 years ago who tell me that they're still using the techniques that I shared with them in a matter of a week. So it gives the children the ability to express themselves in ways that they don't normally have.
Well, Bart, I would like to conclude our conversation today with the name of a fellow that I followed for years and was very fond of just through television. But Arthur Fiedler was always such a favorite for me. And you've had a connection to the Arthur Fiedler story.
Yes. We enjoy Christmas concerts here at the university in Storrs, Connecticut, by the Boston Pops. Every year they come in, they ask somebody at the university if they would read the night before Christmas while the orchestra plays the music. And I got the phone call and was asked if I would read the night before Christmas, and my response was no. And I said, well, we'll do it, but I'm not going to read it. And so I had a couple of students build a puppet that popped out of a huge present box and interacted with Keith Lockhart, the conductor, and read the story. And after the concert, Keith came to me and said, you know, I've been doing this probably 100 times every year for the past 20 years, and that was the most fun I've had. What can we do together? And next thing we knew, we were preparing a show to be done in Boston in Symphony Hall with the Boston Pops. Part of the show was going to be Peter and the Wolf that we had mounted a few years before, but absolutely perfect to do with an orchestra. And usually when we go into a town to work with their orchestra, we ask for a local celebrity to become the narrator. Well, here we're going into Boston. You know, every other person's a celebrity. So I turned to the staff of the Boston Pops and said, would you mind if I built a puppet of Arthur Fiedler? And they looked at each other and said, well, we need to check with his son. And his son came back and said, absolutely. So we actually built a caricature puppet of Arthur Fiedler, who narrated the story and also appeared in other pieces that we did during the concert. And after the first concert, the staff came to me and said, you know, we would really like it if Arthur Fiedler could conduct Stars and Stripes Forever.
Of course.
And I looked at my students and I said, you know how in rehearsal I've been saying to you, you need to learn how to read music, but I'm the only one in a room who can look at this and know when things are going to happen without counting? And they all went, uh-huh. I said, I get to do this. So I've conducted the Boston Pops with Arthur Fiedler.
So with this Arthur Fiedler puppet, because this is radio, we have to envision what this is like. Is this a small puppet, large puppet, medium puppet? Where are we? Goldilocks-sized puppet?
Yeah, the head is about human head size, so it's a fairly large puppet. It is a moving mouth puppet, so you can see his mouth move. And as I designed it and worked with one of my alumni to fabricate it, we realized that we could put that full mustache on anything, even an orange, and it looked like Arthur Fiedler.
So as you're conducting this, is your body in plain view, your very own Bart body?
Yes. In this particular show, we didn't hide behind a booth. All the pieces were performed in what we call full blacks. So we were wearing black shirts, black pants, black gloves, and a hood device that we use to mask our face.
Ah, that's how it works. But how do you entertain, how does a puppet Arthur Fiedler conduct the orchestra and still smile at the audience? Well, he never smiled, for one thing.
he kept looking over his shoulder in the beginning. And then as the orchestra, you know, they said to me, just give him a downbeat and you're underway. But I practiced. I know how to conduct. So I was able to do this. And after he got them started and kept looking back over his shoulder to the audience, we turned him around and had him more or less dance for the audience as he conducted.
Okay, I get it. Well, Bart, this has just been a pleasure to have a chance to learn some of the backstory to the Macy's Day Parade and dip our feet into the river of puppetry as well and the history of it all. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
Bart Rockerburton with us. He is the current director of the Puppet Arts Program at the University of Connecticut. If you're not watching the Macy's Parade this year, it's still the very best time of year to talk turkey. And I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean, it's time to learn something about how turkeys talk, the language of turkeys. And we're going to learn about it from a man who lived with wild turkeys for months on end, in part to figure out how they communicate. Joe Hutto on the way. You're listening to Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Domestic turkeys are notoriously dumb, but I'm pretty sure that's been bred into them. Wild turkeys, on the other hand, that's a different matter altogether. By adopting a brood of newly hatched wild turkeys, Joe Hutto became their parent, and they in turn became his personal wildlife tour guides, showing him a side of the wilderness that very few people have ever experienced before. Hutto is author of Illumination in the Flatwoods. That's the book that inspired the documentary film My Life as a Turkey. I want you to hear a highlight of a conversation that starts out with turkey talk. Don't worry, Joe Hutto will interpret for us. So to me, that sounds like a classic gobbling, and to me, it's gibberish. Does it mean more than gibberish to you?
Well, it stirs something inside of me because I'm so familiar with it, but that's the spring sound of an adult wild turkey gobbler trying to attract a mate. And we're probably more familiar with that call than any other turkey call.
You do speak this language. here's our second sample. Okay, Joe, what can you make of that?
Well, that would be called starting out as a plain yelp, and then it sort of evolves into another kind of call, which is often called a lost call, and that's a sound that a newborn turkey, a poult, makes when they're out of sight of their mother, and as the turkeys mature, they continue making that sound to call to others when they feel separated. And so it evolves from a peep, peep, peep to this sound that you hear in this recording.
Now, I've got one more recording for you, and I'm going to kind of crank the volume on this because there's a mix going on. There's something that's very gentle underneath the louder sound, so there's more than one bird here, and we'll see if we can piece this apart here. There was something like a little gentle fluttering sound in the background. I don't know, Joe, could you hear that?
I can. What that sounds like to me is a mother hen making sure that her brood is in close enough. You know, when they get out of sight as they're foraging along, that she'll make this gentle little sound. And she doesn't want to attract attention from the outside. She just wants right in the immediate vicinity where her poults are, she wants to attract them. So it's a gentle sound.
Did you really become a mother hen?
Yes, I got the eggs. It was an orphan nest, two nests actually, of wild turkeys, and incubated the eggs and actually began vocalizing as best I could to these eggs before they hatched. And as the poults developed and they became a little bit more mature and closer to hatching, they actually started responding to my voice. And so by the time they actually hatched, they already knew who that voice was. And so their objective after they hatched was to seek out and find a pair of eyes that belonged to that correct voice.
So going back to your childhood, when you did this as a kid, was it also with turkeys or other types of birds?
No, anything I could get my hands on, you know, it was opportunistic, and I was just sort of obsessed with wild things as a child, and unfortunately I lived in places where I had access to those kinds of things, and so I started, you know, I discovered this amazing phenomenon of imprinting as a child, and of course, I didn't understand the technical name of it, but what it appeared to me was that if I got an animal young enough, that it identified me as its parent and sort of subverted the horror that most wild creatures have for a human being. And so to me, it was just flat out take it to the bank magic.
Where are you from that you were raised in a way that you'd be inclined to imprint birds or imprint yourself on birds, however the printing works?
Well,
so you find yourself back in Florida when this story begins that became the documentary. Is that where you were again?
Yep. I moved back to Tallahassee for a spell. I was living on this plantation and doing my wildlife art full-time at that point.
And this fellow brings the eggs to you that you had requested, and you sit around watching, waiting, incubating them as a mother hen would do, and then they begin to hatch. Take it from there.
Well, that process, the incubation and hatching process, of course, when I got the eggs, I didn't know how far along incubation had been taking place. And so I candled the eggs, which is you hold the light behind the egg, and you can actually see a poult that's formed in there. And so I knew they were fairly far along, but it took about 10 days, and there's a thing in bird hatching called synchronicity, and that's birds hear the activity of the hatching process and the vocalization, and it inspires all of the other individuals to hatch simultaneously. And so after about 10 days, both the clutches hatched within a 24-hour period. And having done this in the past, what I prefer to do is not expose animals to my humanity, in a sense, to my home or my house, my culture, even my vocalizations. And so I immediately took the young hatchlings out into the wild and let them become familiar with their ecology, not mine. And then we basically spent every day of their lives for the next 9 months, every day without fail, from before daylight till after dark. Continued that for 9 months, and then some of the turkeys, after they became mature enough to head out on their own, they stayed in the vicinity. So actually, my relationship lasted a couple of years in this project.
Joe Hutto, author of Illumination in the Flatwoods. That's the book that inspired the documentary film My Life as a Turkey. I'm Marcus Smith, and this has been our Thanksgiving holiday contribution from Constant Wonder. Learn more about our show and the podcast from byuradio.org. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.